so that you can review it several times in your own mind. That is to say, you can listen to the cassette now. As you listen to the cassette, notice that I'm going over the material again and again. I'm washing the point rather than making the points. I'm capable of making the points. I'm capable of teaching it as a geometric lesson. But what I'm saying to you is that it's very hard to hear this geometrically. It takes a constant single-pointedness of mind to hear it geometrically. Ekagrata in Sanskrit. It takes a constant focus like that. That point is so important that it's given a name. In yoga, in Patanjali's yoga aphorisms, it's called pranama. And by making that single-pointedness of mind, of that pranama, and placing it where you will, the whole structure of the real discloses itself instantly. Instantly. On whatever level you wish. How do you know what's true? You can see it. In instantaneous, accurate disclosure, wherever you place that single-pointedness of mind. If you place it on the self, God is disclosed. But in learning that, it's very difficult because we are used to the world. We are used to a kind of a blur, a kind of a misfocus. And so we have to be encouraged to take our time and learn to uncover, learn to discover the fact that we always accurately in our minds have an exact, correct image, because the image is correspondent with the actuality of the world. You can, if you could go back to your mind with that single-pointedness, you could reconstruct the entire accurate natural setting of any moment in time from the correct positioning of yourself at the central, at your deep self in that moment of time-space. You can recall it into any detail that you required, any detail whatsoever. The accuracy, incidentally, becomes phenomenal. And I've given some examples here from my personal meditative experience from time to time, showing you how just incredibly accurate that whole thing is. You remember that example I gave one time of being up in the high Sierras and going into a deep samadhi about the same time as a juice can falling out of my knapsack, and in the tumble of it, out of the corner of the eye, there was a glint of sunshine off the can. I don't know what kind of nanosecond that is when a can out of the corner of your eye catches a glint of the sun as it tumbles off. And about a minute or two later in that deep samadhi, resolving that glint of sunshine and seeing the can and seeing the sun-kissed brand and all of its regular script and its blue color against the gray of the can, just perfectly accurate. One can, if you can direct the mind with that kind of power, you can resolve whatever accuracy is needed, because the image in the mind is real and corresponds to the reality of the world. As real as the world is, that image in the mind is real. It's not an imitation. You don't have a second-rate mind. You have a first-rate natural continuity with reality. You're sewn into the cosmos. To not know that is ignorance. You occur contemporaneously with it, whatever is occurring, on the same level of reality. So, the topics, and then she gives a quote here from Aristotle's Subjects, Topics, Places. One of these references is in the topics when he is advising that one should commit to memory arguments. What are arguments? Arguments are lines of thought. Lines of thought. Now, what happens when you commit an argument to memory? You are making conscious to yourself the thought process. I had a wonderful teacher at the University of Wisconsin in the late 50s, Julius Weinberg, who at the time was writing a history of medieval philosophy, which Princeton University later had published. Weinberg had been a genius as a young man. He had written a book on logical positivism at the age of 22, which was just the ultimate devastation of logical positivism, its shortcomings. He's an incredibly accurate mind. He saved a good friend of mine one time by defending him in front of the university committee. He had been caught living with his girlfriend, and Professor Weinberg went up to bat for him and defended him against the powers of the University of Wisconsin and won, because he was able to bring out the arguments. Just incredible accuracy. And he would have us learn arguments. And it took a long time for us to learn how to present arguments, pro and con, accurately. Took a long time. Took almost the whole of that year. And only then do you realize that very often people confuse their projected sense of belief with remembering a thought process. And in that confusion, there's a blurring of your capacity to think. It behooves one to understand how to present a line of thought, or as Aristotle would say here, a line of argument, and present it quite accurately. Now, there's a contemporary book written about the time that Professor Weinberg was writing his book on short history of medieval philosophy, by a man named Stephen Toulmin, T-O-U-L-M-I-N, called The Uses of Argument, published by Cambridge University Press many years ago. It's in paperback, Cambridge University Press, The Uses of Argument. Here's the quotation from Aristotle, from the Topics. "For just as in a person with a trained memory, a memory of things themselves is immediately caused by the mere mention of their places." The topoi. Immediately here is stressed. There's no time delay whatsoever. Why is there no time delay? Because they are correspondent. They are resonances on the same harmony, frequency. It's a point of discovery to recognize that this is so. There's no time involved at all. Incidentally, you can resolve that so that you can see that they occur spontaneously together. The training for this in Pythagorean communities was to have pairs of opposites, and to ideationalize pairs of opposites as polarities, and to observe later on that the correct idea, eidos, the correct seeing of the pairs of opposites, that you could cue either one or the other, and the other would be cued with it, with no time delay whatsoever, is a way of showing you that these are eternal capacities and are not dependent on a time relationship whatsoever. There's no temporizing that occurs with their phenomenal occurrence. Hence, Plato's saying these forms are eternal. It wasn't a belief that he had. It was on the evidence of the Pythagorean experience by that time that one could understand. Indeed, these forms are eternal. They're not in time. They don't occur in a time mode whatsoever. Incidentally, the great insight of Socrates was that the human person, the thyself in the phrase "know thyself" was an eternal. Didn't occur in time at all. And that's why he was killed by the state. Only the gods, the difference between the gods and man is primary. The gods are immortal. That is to say, the gods are timeless. They occur in whatever time they want to. But Socrates' radical insight was that man is superior to the old god because he's eternal. He's not just even timeless, but he's eternal. And even a democratic society like Athens put a man to death on that basis. Oh, the accusation was that he's teaching the young men not to believe in the gods of old. That's a watered-down way of expressing it. They accurately saw that this was a radical change in consciousness that they could not accept, would not accept. Let's skip over here, down to the bottom of 31. In the On Dreams, De Insomnis, Aristotle says that some people have dreams in which they seem to be arranging the objects. And I talked about that last week, about how that dream image, if you have that, is a very profound dream image. Your psyche is recognizing that you're beginning to be able to discover the world accurately enough to see that your understanding of it was confused. And at the same time, concomitantly, you're being able to understand that your mind, in its arrangement, was confused also, and that there's a correlation between the confusion of your mind and the confusion of the world. Confusion is a bad term here. It has psychological connotations which are inaccurate. The better word here is inarticulate. Inarticulate. Over on page 32, I've underlined Albertus Magnus and Thomas Aquinas, and they are very great figures in bringing this back into play. There's a connection between imagination and thought. At the basis of 32, at the very bottom, memory is imagination and thought. And when you have imagination and thought, then thinking is conscious. The correct thinking, the true thinking as a function, is conscious. Notice that because thinking then is imagination and thought, that is the meaningfulness brought into nexes of ideas, that they occur together, that imagination is very often subsumed under thought alone. That imagination must be a property of thinking. And this is an error. Imagination can be just as powerful in feeling as in thought, and just as precise. The imaginative capacity of man can be exercised quite adequately in feeling as much as in thought. I won't go into this in any more depth today, but all of the writings of Suzanne Langer are interesting in this respect. She devoted her whole life to involving yourself with trying to make a critique of, is this so? And if it's so, what implications are they? And she did, towards the end of her writing, a big three-volume series, three volumes of books, published by Johns Hopkins University Press that all bear the title, Mind, an Essay on Feeling. Her teachers were Alfred North Whitehead and Ernst Cassirer, and she is a very capable gal. She's one of the greatest philosophers of the 20th century, and she's certainly the example to point to for someone who says that women cannot think accurately as philosophers. That's just not true at all. Why are there so few women philosophers? It goes to show you a cultural skew that everyone has believed. When women have been very accurate thinkers, it's thought to have been an exception. The most profound mind of the 4th century AD was Hypatia in Alexandria. And her terrible death was caused because she was just a real enemy of the state, like Socrates, because she was a living example of how the kind of illusory ideas about human nature were just patently untrue. Women were not supposed to be as accurate thinkers as men because of the nature of the way the world was structured, because of God's handiwork. And Hypatia was just living example to show that that was not true at all. On page 35, there are two paragraphs here, 34 and 35, that deal with an insight into logical order. I won't go in this today, but you can pay attention to that on your own. Page 36, the phrase here that's starred, Plato also uses the seal imprint metaphor in the famous passage in the Theaetetus. The Theaetetus is the dialogue about the sociology of knowledge, in which Socrates assumes that there is a block of wax in our souls, a varying quality in different individuals, and that this is the gift of memory, the mother of muses. Whenever we see or hear or think of anything, we hold this wax under the perceptions and thoughts and imprint them upon it, just as we make impressions from seal rings. Now, Plato in the Theaetetus is speaking in very highfalutin language here, and the seal ring is an emblem of royalty. And it means that which imparts a seal to this inner capacity to us is the royal self. Theaetetus is written late in Plato's life. He's about 75 years old, and he's just tremendously capable. And he uses with great facility these powerful symbolic languages without any effort. And it's difficult for us because we read it as if there were no real effort in it, and we read it with no effort, and we miss the fact that this is just consummate art on Plato's part. Great writer. Plato at 75 is really somebody. On 37, she quotes from the Phaedrus. Now look at how many different dialogues of Plato are indicated here, all the way through this. I checked with the catalogs of UCLA's philosophy department. Do you know how rare it is to find a course in a single dialogue of Plato at a major world university like UCLA? Do you know there has never been a course, an extended course, in all the dialogues of Plato? When one realizes how important the ecology of ideas in the sequence of Plato's dialogues, one asks, what kind of universities do we have that this has never been done? And you know the answer better than I do. You have the words that'll convince you. The art of speaking the truth and of persuading hearers to the truth. Now notice that if you think that the images in your mind are correspondent in an imitative way to images in reality, if you arrange the images in your mind and then speak from that arrangement to convince others, the effect of this activity is what we call politics. Why do we call it politics? Because that's what Aristotle called it, and we've always since called it politics. Politicking. Oh, he's just politicking. Notice that the action which is called politics is a real action, is a spiritual action, and is only seemingly politics because of believing a ignorant position about the activity. This is one of the things that's going to go in the next generation. We're going to pop the bubble that politics is just an exercise in power, that it doesn't have any reality in the world. Well, what people do on a governmental level has a real impress in the world and should not be toyed with, should not be played with as if it's only a power game. The idea that politics is a game of arranging images is one of the things that's going to go. Page 38 and 39, this is probably the most heavily starred of all the sections here. I'll stop with this today. Phaedrus, in the Phaedrus, which is written about 450 BC, Socrates tells the following story. And he mentions in this story about Naucratis. Now, Naucratis was in the delta of Egypt and was a Greek port. It had much the same status in ancient Egypt that, say, Hong Kong would have in terms of China for the British, even though it was a port that belonged to the Greeks. It was totally within Egyptian soil, totally under Egyptian influence, and it was the conduit area from which the ancient Egyptian Hermetic wisdom cores were constantly reminded to the Greeks. Now, Naucratis was in business for an awful long time. It was the only Greek port allowed in Egypt, the only one, it's the only point of contact. Now, Naucratis in Egypt was one of the ancient gods of that country, came from that region. What was the god? Oh, that god was personified by a sacred bird called the ibis. And the name of the god himself was Thuth, or Thoth. He it was who invented numbers and arithmetic and geometry and astronomy and draughts and dice and, most important of all, letters. So notice here what an arcane synchronicity that the Greek conduit of Egyptian civilization should come from the very point where the god Thoth, who invents letters, who invents writing, who invents, in fact, all of the faculties of the mind. If you look at this, these are all faculties of the mind. The god of the mind's functioning is the place where the Greek-Egyptian civilization had its contact for quite some time, about 1,000 years. And then I've underscored here, in the middle of the page, letters, said Thoth, will make the Egyptians wiser and will improve their memories, for it is an elixir of memory and wisdom. That is to say, language is an alchemical elixir. And it's related to the kind of other gold that's in alchemy. What's the other goal of alchemy? Gold. That gold is a symbol of the self, and language is a symbol of the person. So that in the alchemical process, two things happen concomitantly at the same time. Why do they happen concomitantly? Because the mind and the world happen concomitantly. That as the gold is found, the elixir of immortality is also found. But that they are distinct in terms of the mind's perception, but they are resonant, cognate happenings in terms of the real. Now it's a very strange thing. There is a distinct amnesia of one of the parts of this goal of alchemy in the Western tradition. From the 3rd century AD until about the 12th century AD, there is no remembrance in the Western tradition that the elixir is important. None whatsoever. Western alchemical tradition does not have, until the 13th century, in fact, any discussion, any mention at all of elixirs associated with the alchemical process. They come back into the alchemical process because of Western translations from Arabic esoteric texts about the time of Roger Bacon. Roger Bacon's the first time since the 3rd century that anybody talks about elixirs. In alchemy, what are elixirs? Symbols of language capacities of forming the person. Why is that so? Well, the Arabs, incidentally, got it from the Chinese. There's no discussion in Arabic alchemy either until they get it from the Chinese in the Sung Dynasty. In Chinese alchemy, all the way through, there is never any separation at all in alchemical cognizance of gold and elixirs going together. They always go together. In fact, they're often tried to force together to say, well, you'll have immortality if you eat little specks of gold. That the elixir has the gold in it. There are all sorts of mechanical attempts to merge the two together in Chinese alchemy. And it's terrible because in Chinese alchemy, the gold is derived from cinnabar, the mercurial energizing of the process of the alchemical process to get gold comes from cinnabar, which is mercury sulfide, mineral mercury sulfide. And if you ingest mercury, you will get mercury poisoning. If you eat little bits of cinnabar, you'll get mercury poisoning. First thing that goes is your hair and your nerves, and finally your whole mind is just a blurred shamble. It never happens in Western civilization. And of course, what one would like to ask and what we do ask is, why is this so? Why for 1,000 years is there no discussion of elixirs in alchemy if it's so integral to the very process? And then the shock, the realization, it's almost like a waking up out of a dull headache. The realization is that the whole process of the elixir business has to do with language and the formation of the person. And then you look at so-called Western civilization in that 1,000 years, and the general term up until recently was the Dark Ages. Why the Dark Ages? Because nobody was becoming a person. Oh yeah, there were people. There was nobody who was really mature. In the 9th century, you find only one original mind in the whole sweep of Western civilization. John Scotus Eriugena is the only one original mind in that entire time. In fact, if you take a look at Bertrand Russell's famous characterization of the process, he says that the Dark Ages were a vast plateau of mediocrity with one pinnacle, the mind of John Scotus Eriugena, dominating it in its loneliness for hundreds of years. Why is there no originality? Because there are no fulfilled persons. Because that whole capacity was siphoned off and said to belong to only one person. Only Jesus is a real person, and everyone else is, at best, feeding off his reality. So you can see what a tremendous, powerful perilousness there is in misunderstanding. It isn't just that these are like little points of refined philosophy. It's like a real structural insight into what makes or breaks worlds. What allows you to be who you are, and what will stop you, and you don't even know you've been stopped. You don't even know you've been shunted off on a short circuit that leads nowhere, or leads at best to a capacity to improve your fantasizing, so that you think because you increase your cleverness of fantasizing that somehow you're growing in consciousness. It's insidious, and it's got to come to a stop. The plug has to be pulled. Now, the first time that the plug was pulled on this particular massive structural problem was in the 13th century. But it didn't hold. The plugs were put back in. And it had been a constant struggle since then to try and keep things open. So this whole section here on page 38 centers around language as the elixir of memory and of wisdom. And that language is related to the person, person formulation. Achieving your full personage is that immortality. Why? Because it occurs in sync with the reaching of the deep self. One has the elixir when one has made the gold. One has that access to the deep eternal self when one has become one's person. And this is always what magic is really about. This is always the high magic. It's the magic of life that this is so. Now I'll just make one other observation here. It reads down here on page 38, you have invented an elixir, down at the bottom, not of memory, but of reminding, and you offer your pupils the appearance of wisdom, not true wisdom. This is to accept the Aristotelian-based mimetic representational quality of the images of the nature of the mind. The tack taken in the Hermetic tradition to cure this is that however much the images in the mind are appearances, the occurrence of things in the world are appearances also. So as much as the world is a world of appearances, the images in the mind are appearances. It reinstates the resonance between the two of them. And the saying is, you're as real in your images as the world is in its things. And by achieving that parity again, by achieving that harmony, the false problem is resolved. In other words, you don't have to teach someone the esoteric, deep self truth. If you just get them to achieve that parity in their realization that the images in their mind may be just appearances, but they're as real as the appearances of things in the world, Once you achieve that parity, then it's all right. Everything else follows. The day follows the night. Then to your own self, you're being true. And this particular renaissance, that is to say, the remembering of what I have just told you, was what powered the Renaissance. And the Renaissance was brought finally and formally and completely to England by Giordano Bruno in the 1590s. He lived there for several years. And that's the time that Shakespeare really got his going, his insights. He was a part of that group. He knew Bruno, the young Shakespeare. Young, he was in his late 20s, early 30s by that time. And Bruno in England is really something. When Bruno went back to the continent, because he was such a threat, he was put to death, just like Socrates. He was burnt at the stake in 1600. Why do they do this? Because such persons, if they're right, the whole show is up. It's not a question of factoring in somebody's argument into our scheme. That doesn't factor in. It cancels out. The radical person of truth is always put to death. It's not because of a scapegoat thing. It's because they're incommensurate. They're incommensurate. What's the old saying? If I'm right, you're wrong. Now, in more ancient times, like in India, if you came across someone who had a better understanding to you, then you became their pupil. And a teacher who comes across a teacher who understands things better, then they become their pupil. It was like that. But when you get into that worldly power play, you can't factor in the superior understanding. What is the superior understanding? Not just a better idea, but the proof that what you've been working with is just ignorance and illusion. There's no way to factor that in. Your pattern of power no longer holds itself, no longer sustains itself. Why? Because the power is only there as long as you believe it. If your belief is injured, your power is curtailed. Why does evil flee the light of day? When day comes, darkness is gone. That's why. It's like that. Well, I'm trying to show you in some of these notes how much of a resonance there is. That it isn't just Frances Yates' book, The Art of Memory, but it's the implications of everything that she talks about, which remind us or give us a focus of reminding us of how all of this forms a single ecology. It forms a single history. It forms a single experience of which we now, in March of 1989, we are able to camp out on these grounds. We're able to, with all integrity, come to these very grounds, come to this very tradition, and bring our lives and our experience and our understanding and test what we believe and what we understand against these eternal fires. And to just be open enough to let that testing happen and understand that if we do that, if we're open to that, if we let that testing process go on, the gold will come out of that, the elixir will come out of that. Now this is really in its finest characterization. This is the scientific consciousness in the finest sense, spiritual sense. This is a scientific consciousness that if you investigate the natural with integrity, you will not only understand nature, but you will find yourself. You will be there, and nature will be understood. That's the very essence of the scientific process of inquiry. Please bring alchemical studies next week, those of you who can tear yourselves away from whatever it is.